All right, our second case this morning is 2020-866, the State of Ohio versus Kelly A. Foreman for the appellant. First, we have Mr. Jaquith arguing.
Thank you, Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court. As the court is aware, Mr. Carey and I will be dividing argument time this morning as evenly as possible. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This case hinges on how possess is defined for the purposes of the felony drug possession statute. If one takes a common sense approach urged by the dissent and followed by the Fourth District Court of Appeals in City of Logan versus Cox, then the state would have had to prove that Ms. Foreman had a certain quantity of drugs in her possession or under her control in Seneca County. If, on the other hand, one takes the approach of the majority below and the court in State versus Shrimplin, then it suffices for purposes of possession and thus venue that Ms. Foreman tested positive for drugs in Tiffin in late March 2018. To use the phrasing used by the Shrimplin court, which has been challenged by Ms. Foreman at every stage of the case, whether the cocaine was in appellant's pocket or in his urine is of no effect. But Ms. Foreman, however, respectfully submits that the Shrimplin approach is fundamentally flawed and the holding of the Fourth District in Cox is correct and should be applied here. In Cox, a minor was given a breathalyzer test, which showed the presence of alcohol in Mr. Cox's body. Fourth District Court of Appeals, after discussing several cases from other states, which found that assimilated drugs could not serve as the proper basis for a drug possession conviction, determined that the breathalyzer evidence could not support a minor in possession of alcohol conviction against Mr. Cox because the prosecution was unable to establish where and when Mr. Cox possessed the alcohol that he had previously consumed. The key language relied on by the Cox court drawn from prior decisions in other jurisdictions is as follows. The drug has been assimilated into the body. The ability to control the drug is beyond human capabilities. Here, similarly, the only evidence is that Ms. Foreman tested positive for drugs. There's absolutely no evidence about the where and when of Ms. Foreman's possession of a usable form of cocaine. Thus, the state did not and cannot establish a venue in Seneca County. If instead of Cox, this court may be inclined to follow the lead of the majority below, or the Shrimplin opinion, the rule of lenity as codified at Ohio Revised Code section 2901.04 creates an insurmountable hurdle for the state. Assuming arguendo, the General Assembly may have meant for assimilated drugs to serve as the sole basis for a possession conviction, but it is also reasonable to conclude, as the dissent did below, as we submit, is much more likely, the General Assembly meant to criminalize only the possession of drugs in a usable form, as an ordinary person would read the statute, then lenity requires that the more defense favorable interpretation prevail. This results in the conclusion that Ms. Foreman stands unlawfully convicted of drug possession because the state failed to show when and where Ms. Foreman possessed cocaine. The dissent did a magnificent job of laying out why Ms. Foreman's position should prevail here. I think added to the dissent's view would be the rule of lenity analysis laid out in our briefing. Unless the court has questions.
Counsel, I understand your argument about where, but technically we know when she had drugs. She said she took them while she was pregnant, right?
In a range, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, she made some statements.
So we know when. I was just responding or asking to make sure I understood the facts because you said we don't know when.
Yes, I suppose that implicitly I was contrasting it with a case like State McGowan, which is in the briefing, where there was a 2 to 4 hour window of prior consumption. And the testing, along with expert testimony, established that 2 to 4 hour window. Here we're looking at her last admitted usage was roughly a week to 10 days before the testing.
Right. Thank you.
If the court doesn't have any questions, I'm prepared to yield my time to Mr. Carey to discuss constitutional issues.
All right. Mr. Carey.
Thank you, Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court. My name is David Carey, representing the Amicus Party, the ACLU of Ohio. The state has offered two venue theories over the course of this case. One was that Kelly Foreman was in Seneca County when she held cocaine in her hand or when she used it, possessed it in the traditional sense. But as Mr. Jakewith explained, the state failed to gather or present evidence to support that conclusion beyond a reasonable doubt. So they've now presented another theory. And it's the second one that creates a major constitutional problem. No one disputes that the presence of cocaine or metabolites absorbed into bodily substances can constitute evidence of prior possession somewhere at some time. But the state is now arguing that it constitutes possession in and of itself. Even if the statute did support that interpretation, prosecution under that law would be unconstitutional under the Eighth Amendment and under Article 1, Section 9 of the Ohio Constitution. Because under that theory, once a person takes a substance that is prohibited in Ohio, regardless of where and when they do that, they would be continuously reoffending simply by being here. And for as long as medical and forensic technology could detect metabolites, that person would be physically incapable of not offending, not because of a compulsion to act, as with addiction, but because no act would be needed at all. And that is exactly the kind of status offense that the US Supreme Court found unconstitutional in Robinson, and then again in the plurality opinion in Powell. And for good reason. If possession could be by assimilation, a person could be convicted without ever holding or using a substance in a place where it is unlawful to do so. Their status would effectively render them radioactive, continuously reoffending wherever they went. And this would be for an extended period of time because cocaine metabolites are detectable in urine for several days. In meconium, as we saw in this particular case in the record below, it can be detectable for months after the actual use. And in hair, it can be effectively detected indefinitely as long as the hair is still present to be tested.
You're essentially saying that this second venue theory is a status violation.
Precisely, Justice Brenner.
And I think there's already evidence, or excuse me, a case law out there that we don't criminalize drug addiction.
Yes, that is correct. And that is the Robinson v. California case. And this court has observed that in Akron v. Roland, that their case, I believe the court said the case law is legion, that status cannot be criminalized.
So it seemed like it's the Prosecuting Attorneys Association's theory that because she had the baby in Seneca County and gave birth, that somehow there was a transmission that occurred at the point of birth. But it seems like if they found it in the umbilical cord tissue, I don't think that was a one-off kind of thing. Do you?
Well, again, we don't dispute that the presence of the substance in the body can indicate prior use. But in order to satisfy that requirement of venue, what they've essentially argued here is that the presence in the body at that moment was possession. And that's the part that creates the status distinction. By having a substance in your body, by having the status of being someone who once did that, who once used it, regardless of where and when, that status is what is being criminalized under that theory.
I understand. It just seemed like the Prosecuting Attorneys Association's argument was somehow that the birth was some kind of a marker where there was somehow the possession or the passage. And I'm just thinking about the fact that it was in the umbilical cord. That meant that it had to have been there before the child was born.
Right. It would have been before the child was born. I don't think that's been disputed here. And what's the offense here is one of possession. So the theory, as I understand it, is far simpler than that. It's simply that because she had it in her body at that moment, she possessed it. And because it was found in the umbilical cord, that is evidence that she possessed it while the umbilical cord was in her body. And that is the status that we are saying is being criminalized here and is unconstitutional. And the plurality in the Powell v. Texas case elaborates on this a bit, talking about the act status distinction. In that case, they were talking about public drunkenness. Again, punishing the status of being drunk, of being intoxicated, was impermissible on its own, without the act of choosing to be in public. Even if that act in and of itself would have been innocuous, the combination of the status and the act could be punished, but the status in and of itself could not. And that's true even if the drunkenness was voluntary. And that's also consistent with Robinson, which dealt with the crime of being addicted to narcotics, which the court found unconstitutional. While certainly no one chooses to be addicted, the addiction may well be the ultimate result of a voluntary act. But criminalizing that status is unconstitutional either way. So I'll pause there for a moment if the court has any further questions about the Eighth Amendment matter before I proceed to discussing privilege. All right, another impact from the state's novel theory of possession here would be to effectively turn almost anyone who gathers or possibly even encounters a positive drug screening into a mandatory reporter. Currently, it is the law that many doctors can be required to testify if called upon to do so about the results of a screening, but they would not be required to affirmatively report. And as we explained in our briefing, this ruling could change that. Contrary to the state's arguments that they've made in briefing, no one is suggesting that this court limit reporting requirements. Instead, we're saying that this court should not countenance the state's invention of a new doctrine that would have the effect of massively expanding those reporting requirements, effectively turning a doctor or anyone else who encountered a positive screen into a mandatory reporter. That would upset the balance that this court has observed in Antill and in Smorgala and in other cases.
So, I mean, if a doctor observes that a baby is born addicted to drugs, do you think that the doctor should not be able to report that?
No, Your Honor. If there are currently mandatory reporting requirements, then we are not suggesting those be disturbed. What we're saying is that the impact of this case, as explained in our briefing, the impact of the state's theory would be to turn any doctor, regardless of context, who encountered a screening result of that nature into a mandatory reporter. So it would be expanding the mandatory reporting. And it would upset that public interest balance that this court has observed several times between preserving patient confidentiality and preventing a chilling effect on seeking treatment versus the state's interest in investigating crimes.
Counsel, if the doctor was required to report, for the child welfare, could he have reported her for this drugs in her system and child endangering been an appropriate response by the state?
Yes, Your Honor. We're not suggesting that that law needs to be changed. In fact, we're simply arguing that it should not be changed.
Well, okay. All right. She was charged with possession when the state could have just as easily charged her with child endangering.
If the elements of that offense were met, Your Honor, and I take no position on that.
Okay.
So one final point, and I want to reserve some time for Mr. Jake with rebuttal. Much of the state's brief here is given over to the idea that Ms. Foreman personally must be punished somehow. Now, it's worth noting this case is about criminal prosecution, and no one is suggesting that drug use is irrelevant to child custody determinations. But this case is actually more fundamental than that. The state does not have the power to punish someone under criminal law unless it can prove they committed an act that was illegal at the place and time that it was done, and that that place was within the power of the sentencing court. The state here is effectively asking to lift that limitation on its own power, to allow prosecutors and courts to reach outside their territory and perhaps even extend one state's laws into another state by criminalizing the ongoing status of being a person who once did something as its own continuing offense. Robinson prevents that expansion of power, so I urge this court to reverse. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. First, we're going to hear from, is it Ms. Barish?
Ms. Barish. Chief Justice O'Connor, Justices, may it please the court. My name is Rebecca Barish, and I am Assistant County Prosecutor in Seneca County, and I represent the state of Ohio in this matter. At this time, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for amicus. The state of Ohio would assert that through the facts and circumstances of Ms. Foreman's case, that possession was properly established within Seneca County, Ohio, and as was venue. Your Honors, on March 15th, 2018, JB entered this world in Tippin Mercy Hospital in Seneca County to Miss Foreman. The delivery was normal. However, shortly after his birth, many tests were done on him, including an Apgar test, which quantifies infants' health and measures that against infant mortality. His scores began to increase, and Tippin Mercy is prepared to deal with children that have a level of 8 or lower. JB had a score of 12. That, along with other tests, specifically of his urine, his stool, and umbilical cord, tested positive for cocaine. That, along with the Apgar test, indicated to doctors that he was suffering from neonatal abstinence syndrome. Because of that, he was life-flighted to St. Vincent's Hospital, who was more prepared to deal with that severe condition.
Counsel, based on all those facts, wouldn't it have been better to charge the mother with child endangering?
Your Honor, I believe that the facts and circumstances go more towards, obviously, the indication of possession of cocaine. There are certain restrictions with child endangering that we are unable to, obviously, we do not want a chilling effect, but we want to make sure that the proper charge is, in fact, charged and prosecuted, Your Honor.
What was wrong with child endangering? Why was that improper? Why would child endangering have been improper? It seems like that's exactly what she did.
Your Honors, we would assert that I believe other case law had supported the possession of drugs, specifically cocaine, to be better suited for this. The elements were proper through this course.
Well, counsel, you mentioned, I think just briefly in response to Justice Donnelly, you said something about a chilling effect. Explain that.
Yes, Your Honor. Obviously, we do not want mothers who are pregnant to not seek medical assistance or help or to give birth at home. We want them to obviously go to the hospital to be able to give birth properly.
So counsel, are you saying that if child endangering was the charge that was she was indicted upon, it would be more of a chilling effect than possession of a controlled substance, here cocaine? One's more chilling than the other?
Your Honors, I would assert that child endangering, after having so many convictions, would be an increase in a felony. It goes from misdemeanor to felony. And obviously, I do not know the exact amount with what occurs with Job and Family Services. However, our policy through our office is to prosecute this as a possession of drugs rather than child endangering. Your Honor,
how much, I guess your theory is she possessed it because she had the drug in her system. So under the statute, is there any minimum amount that someone needs to have to be guilty of possession of the drugs in their system?
Your Honor, I believe that cocaine is, the definition of it includes metabolites. And as drug tests are conducted, the metabolites, when they are still found, are still constituted as the actual drug of cocaine.
How long do metabolites last in someone's system?
I believe it could be up. I do not know the exact. I do not want to miss the court. I do not know the exact timetable. I know it can be rather lengthy because it's a metabolite. I would say probably up to a week to 2 weeks.
But again, if someone travels to a country with liberal drug laws and uses an illegal drug and they come back to the United States, they can be charged with possession.
Your Honor, I would assert that there was an act, and further, in the United States, it is still illegal to be in possession of that drug.
So it's illegal if you went to Amsterdam, for example, and used cocaine, came back the next day, and there were traces of it in your blood or hair. That would be illegal in Ohio?
If for some reason that you were submitted to that testing, then yes. But again, I would assert that there has to be something that would have flag you, or not flag you, but something that would put you, say if you're driving a car and you were under the influence, then yes, that would.
And Counselor, it's interesting you mentioned that because Chapter 2925 makes no mention of drug metabolites. So it's unclear whether we can even consider that it qualifies as a drug offense. And to your point, Chapter 4511 does talk about controlled substances and metabolites. So don't we have to follow the maxim where, you know, the legislature obviously intended metabolites to be considered a drug or be considered in the offense in one statute, and because the legislature does not have it in another, that was the intent?
Your Honor, I would still assert that the definition of cocaine is still controlling, that when we look to the possession of cocaine is still defined as a metabolite, that it, even though it is specifically delineated in 45, the definition of cocaine still stands even in 2925. Even though it's not specifically delineated, I think it is still proper to support that a metabolite form is still cocaine.
What about the definition of possession? Doesn't that have an element of control to it?
It does, Your Honor. However, supporting a case law such as Moyer would also include that possession can be asserted through constructive possession, as well as looking to the facts and circumstances that involves not just what is mentioned in that definition. It is further, it's not just a very minimal view that is being presented by the appellant. However, it is still able to be understood throughout case law to expand to more. And we need to look at the facts and circumstances, as was it here, through the appellant who admitted that she used 6 to 12 times throughout her pregnancy every 2 to 3 weeks, and that she had done so a week and a half before giving birth. That is supported.
If investigators could get her to admit that, why wouldn't they ask her where she did it?
Your Honor, it was Job and Family Services who had spoken to her. She did not make contact with the detective in this case, who had tried repeatedly to make contact with her. So Job and Family Services had asked her. However, they're not law enforcement necessarily know to ask that question, and that was not asked.
I want to go back a little bit to Justice DeWine's question. What facts and evidence show control, however minimal, while in Seneca County? Could you delineate those facts in the record?
Your Honor, we would still assert that even if it is in the body, it is still in possession. Shrimplin does not go against it, whether it's in the pocket or in the urine, or we would assert here the umbilical cord, that it is still being possessed and controlled in her body. Obviously.
But Counselor, I mean, the majority of cases across the country finds, you know, things in your system is the antithesis of control. That, you know, because as you say, possession does convey a sense of control over something. But when it's in your digestive system, you have no more control. Once a drug is ingested, the power of a person to control it, possess it, or use it is at an end. It doesn't exist. You can't give it to someone else. You can't flush it. You don't. So, and isn't that what the case law really across the country holds?
Your Honors, I would still assert that even though it is within the body, it is still present and still in the control state. Obviously, Ms. Foreman chose not to present Job and Family Services with a drug test when asked. She said she wanted to wait until she would be clean. Your Honors, even though that you may not be able to pull it out of your body, it is still able to be in the body. And through that, it is through the umbilical cord, it is still present.
Counsel, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Could she be charged with possession in every county? If she were traveling throughout Ohio, could she be charged with possession in every county?
Your Honor, we would assert it is found to be in Seneca County because that is where it was tested. That was where it was made available because that is where she gave birth. We're not trying to say that she should be found guilty everywhere. but if not here, where? Because obviously,
I'm not saying guilty. I'm saying charged. Could she be charged if she went from several counties?
If she gave birth in that county, then yes, possibly. Looking at the facts and circumstances.
Okay, so you're only saying there's some evidence. Because she gave birth, there was some physical evidence that she had cocaine metabolites in her system at that particular time.
Yes.
Okay. Counsel, you said that the control about ability to, use it, pass it on, whatever. Here, she used it and she passed it on to her unborn child. Are you saying, to me, that is the definition of child endangering. So I keep going back to the inappropriateness of, the charge compared to what we were actually presented with here, which is child endangering, with a child that was born addicted, obviously, which suggests more than just a casual use of drugs, contrary to her representations. I know you're saying this is your office's policy, but like Justice DeWine, I just don't understand why this is the path that we're on in this case.
Your Honor, I would still assert that the facts and circumstances in this case went more towards that she possessed cocaine within Seneca County. I would defer to my colleague at this point, who may be able to answer that question more readily than I.
All right, Mr. Carey.
Mr. Arrow.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court.
I'm sorry, Mr. Hill.
That's fine. To clarify a couple of points, the question of why not child endangering, the state would endorse this court recognizing what occurred here as a whole host of crimes, from felonious assault to child endangering to corrupting another with drugs, all of which have a much higher a felony and punishment level, especially the ability to imprison a defendant than drug possession. I think in that context, treatment was the key issue here as opposed to punishment. As it relates to why not child endangering, I would direct the court's attention to State versus Gray, a case from the early 90s from this court, where child endangering in a criminal context was disfavored. About in 2000, In re Baby Boy Blackshear limited that holding and argued that could be a reason for a permanent custody determination. If this court would like to revisit State versus Gray and allow for a child endangering prosecution in that regard, the state would not in any way oppose that.
I don't understand what you're saying. Child endangerment in a criminal context is disfavored. Child endangerment is a criminal statute. So what other context would it be used in?
Well, in the concept of a child being endangered as it relates to abuse, dependency, and neglect was found to be an appropriate reason for a permanent custody determination in In re Baby Blackshear. In State versus Gray, this court found that child endangering could not lie in a criminal prosecution under facts somewhat similar to this case. However, the state would not oppose that being revisited because child endangering in this context seems to be an incredibly appropriate charge, as well as possession.
Well, if the elements of the crime are met, there's no reason the state can't charge him with that.
Correct, with the exception that State versus Gray, as a matter of precedent from this court, says that charge is not available to the state in charging a mother with having a drug addicted child. And again, if the state would embrace the court departing from that, I think child endangering in that context would be exceptionally appropriate in this regard. To a certain extent, the state was limited in what they could charge to get Ms. Foreman into treatment.
Well, counsel, let me just understand. You say State v. Gray precludes the state from charging a drug-addicted mother who gives birth to a drug-addicted child from being charged with child endangering?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. It's 62 Ohio State 3rd, 514. Very early on in the decision, the defendant in that case was a Tammy Gray. But again, the state would welcome this court revisiting State versus Gray. That would be, I think, a very just result in this regard. As it relates to status, there's a great difference between the defendant in Powell and the defendant in Robinson and the defendant here. Her status of being a drug addict is not being prosecuted here. Drinking alcohol in Powell is legal. And this is not an issue where we have old track marks on somebody's arm. In the context of possession, there wouldn't be any issue if Ms. Foreman bought a bag of cocaine to the hospital here. The cocaine was found in her blood and in her child's bodily fluids. In addition to that, the question of how long a metabolite stays in the blood, the state would draw this court's attention to State versus Scott, a Cuyahoga County case, where we get a number, which is 72 hours. So in this regard, we know that Ms. Foreman used cocaine within 72 hours of birth. And in that context, you know, we know that she has exclusive control of her child.
Under the state's theory or argument, could after the baby was born, if the father came to the hospital and picked up the baby and went home and the metabolites were still in the baby's body, isn't he possessing drugs? Then he could be prosecuted, well, right?
I don't believe that's a fair way of looking at that. Truly, when we're looking at drug possession, there is a great difference between if I pick up a drug addicted friend at the hospital and drive them home, I'm not being charged with possession of drugs because of the exclusive control argument really doesn't sound. There is a great difference between having a child that you are directly passing drugs to. The cocaine that this child had, it directly comes from the mother. There's no other way for that child to get cocaine in its system. I would argue that the context of the father bringing the child home, you know, because that child has drugs in its system does not constitute possession. And yes, ma'am.
The thing is, the fact, look, there's a piece of the umbilical cord still attached to the baby when the baby's born. So in that tissue, they found drugs. How do we say that at the moment of birth was the passage of the drugs from the mother to the baby's system? Well, we really don't say that because we know the baby was born drug addicted because the Apgar score went up the longer the baby wasn't getting continuous supply of cocaine from the mother's system. So I still don't understand how that point of birth creates the possession on the part of the mother. I understand your co-counsel talked about the metabolites, but can you help me?
Certainly. Yes, Your Honor. The idea that the mother's blood is still in the umbilical cord, physiologically speaking, that's a fact. The umbilical cord is truly the sharing of both the child and the mother. So the idea that the blood in the umbilical cord is much like taking blood from Ms. Foreman's arm, taking blood from the umbilical cord has the exact same effect as it relates to control over that. So that's the idea. I think the concept of at birth relates to discovery. Had Ms. Foreman been driving in an impaired state or had an involuntary manslaughter cause of death after a traffic accident, and it was found that she was driving in an impaired state, the blood taken at the time that one would presume that she was in the hospital or with law enforcement would constitute the marker of time of when it was discovered.
But you couldn't charge that mother for possession of drugs, though. If you didn't find drugs in the car, you couldn't charge her with possession if you just found it in her system, could you?
Yes, Your Honor, you can. And that's the Shrimplin and Napper and McGowan deal with the fact where in most of those cases, an individual has committed another crime while high on cocaine. All of these are cocaine cases. And the individual's blood is tested because cocaine is found in its metabolite form. And I believe when you look at the definition of both cocaine as well as how broad possession is under 2511, it allows for cocaine to be in its metabolite form because it's allowed to be in any container, whatever that may be, whether it's the bloodstream or if it's being mixed with something else, that still constitutes cocaine. It just so happens that
the Shrimplin and those line of cases are unreported and they're unsupported by any other law.
Well, Your Honor, if you're looking for a reported case in that regard, I would encourage you to look at State versus Lowe from the early 90s out of the 4th District, where you have a similar situation. And the 4th District said, well, we're uncomfortable with just having the possession of cocaine metabolite in that individual's bodily fluids. We would, if there was something else to substantiate it, if the person was around drug materials, if the person confessed, which is what we have here, she's admitted on a number of different occasions to using cocaine while pregnant. And by State versus Scott, we know that even though she didn't, that it was in her system within 72 hours of her use. So she didn't tell the Job and Family Services that she used it in the hours or days before the birth of her child. She chose to keep that out. But it doesn't change the fact that it occurred. And I think that State versus Scott endorses that. And I think so when we look at
to take State versus Scott and say it had to be within 72 hours and she admitted it, that she used it. So you're going to impute the 72 hours to State versus Scott. And then how do you get to the fact that it was that when she used it, it was in Seneca County? How do you get there?
Again, it's the possession does not require use. And I think that that's one of the big differentiations that needs to be made here. Again, if this was cocaine in a baggie in her purse, we would say, oh, absolutely, it's possessed because it's within her dominion and control.
Sure, but it's the flip. She didn't possess it and she used it. How do we get venue from that?
Because its presence concerns its control and its possession. If it's present, and specifically cocaine metabolite, which is what all of these cases concern, its presence in her body at a time that it is discovered constitutes possession. On the same token, there was a question said, well, if she drove through a number of states while possessing the drug, could she be prosecuted there? And the answer is yes. And I would encourage you to look at it in the context of an RSP case. Someone receives stolen television sets in Toledo and they're going to fence them in Franklin County. Well, as you're driving to Columbus, you could be prosecuted if it was discovered in Wood County or Hancock County. If that person happened to be discovered in Marion County, Marion County is the most likely place for the prosecution to occur, but it's not the only case. But discovery is what drives situs for many prosecutions, which is why it drove it here. So, but possession was discovered in Seneca County.
Counsel, so can every probationer who's on probation for a felony that comes in and tests positive for cocaine now be charged by the state with possession?
The question of there's a can and a will question there. Can the person be charged if they have a dirty screen for cocaine specifically in a probation office? Yes, that person could be charged with possession of cocaine. That's accurate. And I think when you look at the attendant circumstances around that possession as well.
Has that ever occurred to your knowledge?
I do not know of a case, Your Honor. I'd be more than willing to look, but I, at this point, I know of no case where those were the attendant facts. The vast majority of the cases that deal with possession of cocaine metabolite occur where that discovery was made in a case surrounding, for lack of a better term, other issues. And for that matter, I would like to differentiate the minor in possession cases. Alcohol, even the alcohol, the only thing that makes the possession of those individuals of having alcohol in their system illegal is their age. And that is a status issue because the individual in that context could not control their age and the legal possession of that substance. The possession of cocaine is never legal. And I think that that's a distinction that this court should know.
Thank you. Mr. Jaquith, are you going to argue at this point?
He's muted.
Also, we don't have your mic on. Maybe it's on and we can't hear it. Okay, Mr. Carey, would you like to step in?
Very briefly, counsel mentioned the Scott case, which had a passing mention of metabolites being detectable for 72 hours. I would simply mention that that case was from the early 1990s. Technology has evolved since then. And also, the Scott case does not stand for any legal limiting principle. It does not say that metabolites are only useful under the state's theory here if they're detected within 72 hours. It's simply descriptive under the science of the time, saying that it was detectable for 72 hours. And further, as for the discussion, if I understood counsel correctly, as to charging with child endangerment versus possession, if I understood their position correctly, it's that the offense of possession was charged because it was essentially a less harsh penalty. Of course, the elements must still be met.
Yeah, sorry. I think what they said, and to be fair, I went back and read the case that Mr. Harold cited, was there's precedent from this court saying you can't charge with child endangerment for endangering a child who has not yet been born. So that's why they had to charge it this way.
Fair enough. That if they couldn't charge for child endangerment, then they couldn't charge for child endangerment. But that, of course, is not a reason to charge for an offense that where the elements cannot be met or where the offense would be unconstitutional as applied here. And with that, I have nothing further.
Well, I have one follow-up question. State v. Gray, as Justice DeWine was saying, I mean, why wouldn't State v. Gray operate in this situation to prevent prosecution for possession? I suppose maybe because of the question of metabolites, but as Justice Stewart pointed out, that's not really in the statute like it is in 4511. So wouldn't State v. Gray actually help in preventing prosecution in this situation?
I don't know that State v. Gray speaks to the Eighth Amendment issue, but if State v. Gray prevents prosecution for child endangerment, then obviously she couldn't be charged under that. As to possession, our position is simply that the elements have not been met beyond a reasonable doubt, or rather that venue has not been met beyond a reasonable doubt, and that the prosecution would be unconstitutional.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, folks. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you call a 10-minute recess?
The court will now recess for 10 minutes.